program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service. And our first article today is entitled, This Coming Shabbat, the Torah Portion Commands Us to Care for Immigrants. No one knows who wrote the Jewish rabbinic text known as Sefer HaKadosh, or a Book of Guidance. The author, a 13th century rabbi, modestly signed his work, A Levite of Barcelona. But the tome has enjoyed great popularity in the Jewish world for the ensuing centuries, for good reason. The author goes through the Torah and, with impressive erudition and scholarship, defines and elaborates on each of the Jewish Bible's commandments and prohibitions. The Torah portion, Ikev, will be read in synagogues worldwide, was read on Saturday, August 16th. It gives the commandment to love your fellow as well as to love the convert. While Judaism does not seek converts, it allows anyone willing to shoulder the obligations of Jewish law to become part of the Jewish people, with a special order to show favor to a convert. Anyone who shows any degree of disrespect for a convert or causes him any pain, the Sefer HaKadosh explains, violates this commandment. But the author expands upon the idea. We are to learn from this precious commandment to have mercy on any person who finds himself in a foreign place and not ignore him when we find him alone and far from those who can help him. And with these sentiments, we will merit to be treated with mercy by God. The verse hints to this idea when it adds, because you were strangers in the land of Egypt, reminding us that we were once burned with the deep pain felt by any person finding himself among foreign people in a foreign land. And God in his mercy took us out of there. Our own mercy should likewise be felt for any person in a similar situation. That expansion of the commandment is striking and most pertinent today. While immigration is something that rightly has rules, and borders cannot be totally open to all, too many are so willingly jumping on the anti-immigrant bandwagon. But the Jewish attitude toward those foreign-born people, who often have risked their lives to come here, legally or otherwise, is one of mercy and concern. The Love the Convert versus reminder of the Jewish people's sojourn in Egypt is meaningful here, too. Many, if not most, American Jews are no more than a generation or two removed from their own immigrant forebears. Our parents or grandparents found themselves here, far from their birthplaces, as strangers in a strange land. My parents were among those who arrived on American shores from a faraway place, Eastern Europe. My mother fortunately immigrated as a child before World War II. My father immigrated after fleeing Nazis and spending the war years in a Soviet Siberian labor camp. The kindness of those who welcomed and aided them from the start allowed them to marry, come to lead a Jewish congregation in Baltimore for many decades, and raise a family. I knew countless others like them. They came to love this country, which gave them new lives. And although I was born here, I inherited that same feeling. I can easily imagine the pain and fear born of uncertainty that they all must have felt when disembarking from ships that brought them here. I remind myself that similar feelings are felt by more recent arrivals from other places. Immigrants these days are often immediately and unfairly judged to be freeloaders or worse. To be sure, there are immigrants who, by their choices to commit serious criminal acts, have earned the verdict of deportation. But the vast majority of the newcomers have not made any such choices and are not invaders, but guests. We are obligated to treat them as such. That means not only helping them acclimate and offering them practical assistance, but also caring for their feelings. The Talmud teaches that our sensitivity to others extends even to the words we use. In Jewish law, verbal mistreatment, or ona at davarim, is a thing, a big thing. One may not remind a convert, the Talmud teaches, of his behavior before his conversion, or remind the child of a convert of his parents' origins. The implications for how we are to speak to immigrants are obvious. Whatever immigration policy one might favor, and there are legitimate differences of opinion about the larger issue, the Jewish attitude toward the stranger in our midst is, as the Sefer Hakanuk put it, to have mercy on him and not ignore him when we find him alone and far from those who can help him. It is an admonition that all of us, whatever our faiths, do well to internalize. That was written by Rabbi Avi Shafran, who writes widely in Jewish and general media and blogs at rabbiavishafran.com. Our second story. This is domestic terror. Shaken by ICE raids, pastors rethink ministries. This is written by Jack Jenkins for the Religious News Service. When the Reverend Tanya Lopez talks about the day in June when she had to confront masked agents in her church parking lot, she focuses on the man they detained. As the pastor of Downey Memorial Christian Church near Los Angeles, California, she said her primary concern was the person being taken away by the apparent federal immigration agents, though they declined to identify what agency they worked for. But the fact that agents felt comfortable apprehending a man on church property and were willing, Lopez said, to raise a weapon at her even after she identified herself as a pastor, left her shaken. "This is domestic terror, in my opinion," Lopez told Religion News Service in June. "I don't feel safe. I still have to show up at church on Sunday. I still have to lead worship." It's a sentiment shared by a growing number of faith leaders and the communities they serve, as President Donald Trump has enacted a massive immigration crackdown over the past few months, resulting in thousands of detentions and deportations across the country. For many immigrant-heavy congregations, the risk has been amplified by the administration's decision to rescind a long-standing internal government policy of avoiding immigration raids at, quote, sensitive locations, end quote, such as houses of worship. RNS has identified at least 10 instances of apparent immigration enforcement activity conducted by ICE or other federal agents on or immediately near church grounds since Trump's inauguration. DHS officials have repeatedly declined to confirm whether many such incidents enacted by uniformed men in masks who sometimes do not identify which agency they work for, were government-sanctioned operations. The episodes are spread across 5 states and Puerto Rico, and so far have impacted Christian communities, namely Catholic, Evangelical, Cooperative Baptist, and Mainline Christian churches. The episodes have occurred despite four separate lawsuits involving dozens of religious denominations and groups that have been filed against the Trump administration, arguing that any enforcement on church grounds violates the right to freely worship and hinders their ability to serve those in need. Trump administration officials initially denied ICE raids were happening at houses of worship at all. But last week, DHS Assistant Secretary Tricia McLaughlin acknowledged to RNS that incidents have occurred, while insisting officers need secondary supervisor approval before any action can be taken in locations such as a church or a school. McLaughlin added, "We expect those to be extremely rare. Faith leaders aren't finding them rare enough. The Catholic Diocese of San Bernardino, reported at least two instances in June alone where ICE detained people on parish property, one in which agents chased men into the parking lot of the St. Adelaide Parish and detained them, and another where a parishioner at Our Lady of Lourdes was apprehended on church property while doing landscaping. A similar situation unfolded in Washington State in March, when a man was reportedly arrested in a church parking lot while leaving worship with his family. Agents are sometimes confronted by clergy, but faith leaders say officers are often unmoved by their appeals." Lopez, the Downey Memorial Christian Church pastor who filmed the masked men in a clip that received national media attention, said that one agent allegedly told an administrative pastor, "The whole country is our property." Federal agents have also used religious facilities as a staging ground. In May, ICE agents staged an operation on United Methodist Church property in Charlotte during preschool pickup, disrupting families and instilling fear among staff and children, according to a statement from the Western North Carolina Conference. "ICE enforcement activity on our church property interferes with our ability to welcome the stranger, serve our neighbors, and carry out the ministries that are central to our faith," the statement read. "Churches should not be staging grounds for law enforcement. They are sacred spaces where the hurting find healing, the hungry are fed, and families, regardless of immigration status, come seeking peace." 2 months earlier, immigration officials reportedly attempted to conduct a stakeout on the grounds of a North Carolina Cooperative Baptist Fellowship church that offered English as a second language class to immigrants and refugees. The officers eventually left, but the incident became a legal flashpoint. The CBF is a plaintiff in one of the lawsuits challenging the Trump administration's decision to rescind the sensitive locations policy, raising questions as to whether the incident violated a judge's injunction in their case. Immigration officials have also conducted raids in close proximity to churches, a trend faith leaders say can have an equally chilling effect on people in the pews. In January, ICE agents reportedly approached an evangelical church in Georgia during worship, when people inside locked the doors and asylum seekers' ankle monitor began buzzing. The congregant exited to the parking lot, where he was promptly detained by agents. Similar scenes played out in June when one man was detained on the sidewalk outside a Catholic church in Downey, and days later in Newburgh, Oregon, when another man was apprehended on the sidewalk just outside St. Michael's Episcopal Church, sparking backlash from congregants who knew the man and his family. For some churches, the fear of raids has forced fundamental changes to how they operate. The Bishop of San Bernardino has formally lifted the obligation to attend Mass for Catholics concerned about ICE raids, for example, an unusual shift that follows a similar, albeit less formalized, move by the Diocese of Nashville. Rodrigo Cruz, the executive assistant to the United Methodist Church's North and South Georgia annual conferences, said widespread ICE activity in his state has pushed congregations back to pandemic-era worship strategies, online services or small gatherings, as at-risk families prioritize safety over communal worship. We want to gather with people, especially when we are going through some distress as a society, while also acknowledging that the safety and the well-being of our individuals and our families are a priority, said Cruz, who noted the North Georgia Conference is a plaintiff in one of the four lawsuits challenging the policy change. Bishop Brenda Boss, who leads the Southwest California Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, told RNS that church attendance in the region sank in the weeks during which Los Angeles, which is within her synod, became the epicenter of Trump's recent immigration crackdown. Boss, who is also a plaintiff in the most recent lawsuit, said the drop-off impacts more than just the numbers in the pews. Community ministries are also suffering, she said, in part because immigrants make up a significant percentage of church volunteers in the region. It's not just, oh, I'm a hungry person who doesn't dare leave my home, Boss said. Some of these people also drive the trucks to go get food or cook the meals or care for the children. So ministries are stopped also. In Puerto Rico, the Reverend Nilka Marrero has watched several families at Iglesia Metodista in San Pablo skip worship out of fear of being detained. Wow en route. In response, the congregation has worked to arrange transportation to help people feel safe. When agents appear near her church, she barricades worshipers inside. Rebecca Gonzalez Ramos, the special agent in charge of Homeland Security investigations in San Juan, has said she doesn't intend to raid churches. But Marrero said many in her congregation don't trust authorities. They've arrested people in front of the church, Marrero said, noting that hundreds of people have been detained in her part of Puerto Rico over the past few months. The fear permeating her community, the pastor argued, is well-founded. One of the first major immigration raids in Puerto Rico under the new Trump administration happened on a Sunday morning when many were on their way to worship. I'm sorry, I'm old school. Sunday for me is the day of the Lord, and it was very, very disrespectful, Marrero said. People from my church and other churches saw that as a transgression of what we had been taught all our life, that Sunday is a day when you go out to adore the Lord. Next, evangelical legal group asks Supreme Court to overturn same-sex marriage ruling. This was also written by Jack Jenkins for the Religion News Service. A conservative Christian legal group asked the United States Supreme Court to review a decade-old case involving a former Kentucky county clerk who cited her faith when she refused to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. A long-shot effort, activists hope, will result in justices ending nationwide legalization of same-sex marriage. Liberty Counsel, a legal nonprofit that also describes itself as a Christian ministry, has long been involved in the case of Kim Davis, the Kentucky clerk who in 2015 gained international attention after she wouldn't issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples despite the Obergefell versus Hodges Supreme Court decision, which legalizes same-sex marriage nationwide that same year. Davis's refusal, which she said was rooted in her evangelical Christian faith, led to a series of legal battles she lost. resulting in a brief prison sentence as well as being ordered to pay $100,000 in damages as well as additional legal fees. The nonprofit filed a petition with the court on July 24th, requesting an appeal to Davis's case and asking the court to overturn Obergefell. If ever a case deserved review, the first individual who was thrown in jail post-Obergefell for seeking accommodation for her religious beliefs should be it, read the petition. Legal analysts have cast doubt on the likelihood of the court reviewing Davis's case, noting justices already declined to take up an earlier version of her case in 2020. But in an interview with Religion News Service last month, Liberty Counsel founder Matthew Staver said multiple justices have voiced frustration with the Obergefell decision over the years. When the court passed over Davis' case in 2020, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote a statement, joined by Justice Samuel Alito, that blasted the same-sex marriage ruling, saying, "Davis may have been one of the first victims of this court's cavalier treatment of religion in its Obergefell decision. We think that it's not a matter of if, just a matter of when the Supreme Court will overrule Obergefell," Staver said. The court has grown more conservative since the 2020 ruling, with Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who also voiced criticism of Obergefell in the past, filling the slot on the bench left open by the death of liberal jurist Ruth Bader Ginsburg, And Thomas explicitly called for Obergefell to be reconsidered in his concurring opinion for Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, the 2022 ruling that overturned Roe v. Wade, the landmark 1973 decision that legalized abortion nationwide. Staver argued the Dobbs decision left Obergefell in a weak position, and he noted that a case only needs support from four justices to be reviewed. With all of these things, the overruling of Roe, the composition of the court the way it is now, I have a good feeling about the possibility that the court would take this case, he said. Staver also suggested justices may be more willing to take up the case given the passage of the 2022 Respect for Marriage Act, which, among other things, requires states to recognize same-sex marriages if they were performed in places where it is legal. The result, Staver argued, would reduce the nationwide impact if the court once again made same-sex marriage a state-level decision. It has taken one of the policy reasons for not overruling Obergefell off the table, he said. Even so, LGBTQ plus rights activists have long insisted that, even with the Respect for Marriage Act, rights would be lost if Obergefell were overturned. And their supporters include a broad swath of religious Americans. A 2024 Public Religion Research Institute report found majorities of white mainline Protestants, white Catholics, Hispanic Catholics, Jews, and Buddhists all support keeping same-sex marriage legal, and in many denominations now perform same-sex marriages. In the past, clergy have even filed suit to help legalize same-sex marriage at the state level. But Staver said support for his cause is growing, or at least becoming more organized. He pointed to state resolutions passed by lawmakers in Idaho and elsewhere asking the court to reconsider Obergefell, as well as a resolution passed by the Southern Baptist Convention last month that called for overturning the laws and court rulings, including Obergefell versus Hodges, that defy God's design for marriage and family. Next, recalling one of the most difficult decisions a family can make, written by Jeffrey Salkin. The last time a cover story in the Sunday New York Times Magazine pushed my buttons was just a few weeks ago. It was a political story about Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the war in Gaza. But earlier this month, the magazine cover pushed another set of buttons for me one I had not felt pushed for decades. This time, it was personal. The article, Noah is Still Here, tells the story of one family's struggle with a child who was born with a rare genetic disease, trisomy 18, also referred to as Edwards syndrome. Many fetuses with trisomy 18 do not survive to birth or die shortly after and within the first year. Those who live longer suffer grievous health challenges, including severe physical and intellectual disabilities, heart defects, kidney problems, spina bifida, and underdeveloped lungs. Their growth is restricted. They often have craniofacial abnormalities such as a small jaw and cleft lip or palate and limb abnormalities. At the time of the article's writing, Noah, the child of the story, was 4 years old. The article chronicles the struggles his family had that force us to think about the meaning of the phrase quality of life, medical ethics, how we love our children, and the nature of sacrifice in daily life. I first heard the term trisomy 18 more than 30 years ago, when a prenatal exam detected that the fetus of a long-hoped-for second child was afflicted with that syndrome. We had as much medical knowledge as was available then. We already had a son who was 5 years old, and we knew he would witness the predictable death of a sibling within weeks, months, or years, and we wanted to shield him from that. We struggled, we sought counsel, and we made the painful choice to end that pregnancy. It was the right choice for us. As I read the article, I trembled, not only because of the tragic heartache that we avoided, but also because the failed pregnancy happened in New York in 1991. What if we were decades younger and it happened now, after Roe v. Wade was overturned in 2022 and abortion has been restricted in many states around the country? For those whose religious and/or moral codes forbid abortion, as we say in Hebrew, kol ha-kavad, I have respect. I have listened to the philosophical reasoning behind those positions and have learned from them. I have profound respect for their profound respect and awe for life, that all people are made in the image of God. Jewish law makes it very clear that there are times when abortion is not only permissible but necessary and warranted. Those situations include when the health of the mother is in danger. The mother's mental health is part of that. Our decision to end this pregnancy was difficult and tragic, but I emphasize it was the right choice for us. I have respect for those different ideas of beginning of life issues. So too, I have massive amounts of respect for parents who have had to make difficult decisions and chose differently, and who brought these fragile children into the world. I cannot imagine what it would mean to do that, but the ability to do so is truly a gift of God. For them, I have kol hav kavod, or deep, awe-filled respect. We've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call